part of the reason for that is that unless we have a strong kind of foundation in appropriate behavior, if our behavior and our sense of generosity is not strong, it's a little bit harder, quite harder, and to settle down and be generous with our breath, or generous with our inner life, sit down and be stable. If we live an unethical life, relying or doing things that don't make us particularly feel good or make us feel anxious about our deeds because someone might notice or catch up to us or we feel regret about what we've done, then we come down and sit and meditate, that will come and be in a sense kind of a disturbance in someone's meditation. It'll be hard to kind of really settle and be really stable in meditation if one's ethics is not really settled. And one reason I wanted to talk about ethics a little bit today is that because I keep either volunteering or getting pulled in or something into writing ethical documents for Buddhist centers. In the last 10 years, a lot of there's been a lot of scandals in Buddhism, ethical scandals, and as there has been in almost all religions, with the teachers and ministers and all that. And so one of the responses in Buddhist America is to really be careful about ethics and to talk about it more, and also to implement codes of ethics and ethical procedures for the communities. Ethics since about early 80s, right? You probably noticed it everywhere you go. It's ethics, you know, medical ethics and corporate ethics, and well, just the same in Buddhism. So I'm helping to write these documents, and I wrote one for the Zen Center of San Francisco a couple of years ago, and now I'm going to be writing something for Spirit Rock in Marin County. And in thinking about ethics, and thinking about ethics kind of from a Buddhist point of view, I believe, that the contribution that Buddhism has to make, let me back up a little bit. What I've noticed is that when we use the word ethics in these Buddhist communities, for the Zen Center or at Spirit Rock, it makes a number of people nervous. Ethics, in many people's minds, seems to be associated with right and wrong, and seems to be associated with kind of often kind of rigid kind of puritanical attitudes, or rigid attitudes of guilt and blame and being a victim. And people feel a little bit uncomfortable about entering into that kind of world of very clear, you know, right and wrong. Especially seeing how kind of damage that can do when people in our society have done that. However, the meaning of ethics is broader than just the question of what is right and wrong. The meaning of ethics, especially in an academic environment, the word ethics implies just conduct, behavior, the values and the ideas, the motivations which affect the way in which we live our life. So the contribution that Buddhism has to make to this question of what values do we base our life on, or what motivations do we base our activity on in our life, the contribution is that it offers an alternative to traditional, often Western ideas of right and wrong, purity and impurity, evil and good, or sin and purity or whatever. There's very strong dualism in Christian traditions. And in a very traditional stance is you come down, you feel very secure if you know what is absolutely right, if you know where right is and where wrong is. And you can kind of get a kind of personal security or a group security if you have some text or some scripture or some person or some tradition who really lays down the law. This is the way it is and this is the way it's not. God commands the Ten Commandments, and we take them to be Ten Suggestions nowadays. But in any case, you know, we're not so into it anymore exactly. Buddhism also, so traditional ethics, I think, often functions on a kind of dualism, or kind of dualistic distinction between good and bad and right and wrong. Buddhism also bases its ethics on a distinction, on a dualistic distinction. But it's not what I've been listing. Rather, the distinction is between suffering and freedom from suffering, or lack of suffering. And the motivation for spiritual action in Buddhism, or the foundation or the base for understanding how to live an ethical life in Buddhism, is based on whether what we're about to do creates suffering or alleviates suffering. And the advantage, I believe, of this kind of strategy is that it takes the foundation for how we live our life away from idealism or ideals or ideas, away from kind of inherited or received concepts which are somewhat abstract. I mean, right and wrong, you know, it changes, and different cultures have different notions of what is right and wrong. There's some things which are kind of universal, usually you're not supposed to kill, but then religions and philosophies will talk about when it's justified to go to war, when it's justified to kill. So there's, you know, people start hedging their, you know, hedging a little bit about what is right and wrong. And it has a lot to do with ideas. And so, and philosophy. When you base it on suffering, it's not an idea, it's not on philosophy, but rather it's on something in theory that you're supposed to be able to experience. The suffering is, you can experience what it is to create more suffering in life, and you can experience the possibility of wanting to alleviate that and trying to find ways to alleviate it. So the idea in Buddhism, if I understand Buddhism accurately enough, is that it's saying, base your actions on how you experience interactions with other people, your interactions with reality around you, rather than on ideals and ideas, rather than on concepts which are, you know, can be quite abstract. So to base it on something concrete that's experienceable. And what you can experience, you can really experience when you're suffering or when other people are suffering. So Buddhist ethics then is based on this notion of suffering, and also on the notion of empathy, that not only can we be aware of our own suffering, how we suffer, and how we kind of alleviate our own suffering, but it's also based on the idea that empathy is to feel the other person as if we're the other person, or kind of person's shoes, or a kind of physical or bodily resonance of someone else's suffering. We kind of feel a little bit, you know, empathy. We feel kind of the compassion. We suffer with them, in a sense. And based on empathy, then, our actions will hopefully be motivated to alleviate the suffering of the other, if we can, rather than perpetuate it. Now, this all ties back to a meditation practice in Buddhism, because if the foundation of conduct, of how we choose to live our life, has to do with our sensitivity to suffering and what is happiness, in a felt experience way, then we have to find a way to strengthen our ability to really sense and feel what is going on in our relationships and interactions with people around us. And if we're constantly thinking about tomorrow, or constantly thinking about, you know, how to make the most money, or constantly thinking about whatever in our preoccupations, if we're lost in our preoccupations, it's hard to be sensitive to what's going on with other people. So have an ethical life that's based on sensitivity to the situation, it's important to be able to cultivate a very strong mindfulness that allows us to be in the present moment, to register what's going on in the present moment. From the point of view of ethics, that's one of the reasons why we do mindfulness. From the point of view of mindfulness meditation, one of the reasons we do ethics is because it's very hard to be mindful if you're living an unethical life. So if you want to be ethical, it's good to be mindful. And if you want to be mindful, it's good to be ethical. It's like this lawyer who came to retreat many years ago, and he asked the teacher, in my particular area that I work in, I'm expected to lie a lot. Now, can you tell me how I can be a good Buddhist practitioner and continue with my lying? And he expected to have to be told how to do it. And the teacher said, I'm sorry, But actually you can't. You cannot actually cultivate a very strong level of mindfulness, strong level of sensitivity, and continue to do something like lie, or continue to do something like steal or harm other people. Something happens as the heart becomes more sensitive. It hurts more to lie, it hurts to be deceitful, it hurts more to be caught up in hate. And so if you want to continue developing that kind of sensitivity that comes with mindfulness, at some point a person will naturally want to explore and living a more ethically sound life, explore a way of living that causes less harm, that causes less suffering. So there might be other motivations for the choices we make about how we live our life. And certainly there's other things besides suffering and happiness, suffering and the alleviation of suffering. The spiritual stance of Buddhism as a spiritual practice, the spirituality of Buddhism is predicated on this ability that we can feel for ourselves our suffering, the suffering of others, and we can feel for ourselves the possibility to become free of that suffering. And so how we conduct ourselves is a very important part of that. What happens a little bit in American Buddhist circles is that, sometimes it seems that Americans want everything without sacrificing anything. They don't want to give up anything. And it's partly that's a strength that the American Buddhists have. Explore and develop a spiritual life, a sensitive life, a life of enlightenment, a life of spiritual practice, without becoming monastics, which is a tradition in Asia. You became monastics and you renounced the world and you renounced your sexuality and you didn't handle money and you lived a very simple life, in a sense. But Americans say, wait a minute, we don't have to make this kind of sharp distinction between a lay life and a monastic life. We don't have this black and white kind of situation. How about cultivate? We want to cultivate our spiritual life in the midst of our lay life. Thing, I think, and that's, you know, we're all doing that. However, there's a little bit of a, I think, a little bit misguided. When people understand that to mean, I can continue doing damn well whatever I want and be mindful and cultivate a meditation practice. There will be some effect on your behavior if you meditate, unless you're already a saint. Though there's a story in Zen of this guy who was very saintly, and he was so saintly the animals came and kind of sat on his shoulders, and the birds came and, you know, talked to him, and it was kind of everything was kind of radiant around. And then he became enlightened, and the birds stopped coming, and the animals stopped coming. And I don't quite understand the story, except the way it's usually interpreted in the Zen tradition is that the man had been attached to his purity, his ethical purity, as if ethical purity was enlightenment, and it had wonderful, you know, beneficial effects. He was, you know, people were kind of inspired to be around him, but ethical purity is not the same thing as enlightenment, not the same thing as really being deeply released from all the remnants, last of the remnants of clinging that are possible to find in the mind. And to cling to purity is still a form of clinging, and it's still a trap to really becoming free of all forms of suffering. So what I'm trying to say is that it's a little bit of a misguided to think that we don't have to look at our conduct if we want to develop a more sensitive life, a more compassionate life, a more awakened life. And that it's useful sometimes to look at how we live our lives, the choices we make, the kind of livelihoods we engage in. Where do we get our money from that we live on? There's a wonderful teacher who now lives in Half Moon Bay named Usilananda, Burmese monk, to a conference in 1990. On ethics, Buddhist ethics, and among a lot of other teachers there. And the teachers there were asked, what is the biggest ethical dilemma that you find yourself in as a teacher in your community? And And his response was, well, the biggest ethical dilemma I have is that I'm the monk or the teacher for a lot of the Burmese people in the Bay Area. And they come to me, and some of them, you know, it's very hard for these Burmese immigrants to find work. And it's a big deal for them to find work and be able to support their families. And they come to me and they say they've managed to find work, and they're working in a company that makes tanks, or makes missiles, or makes ammunition, makes some kind of weapons. And they ask him, is that okay? Is that ethical from a Buddhist point of view? And his ethical dilemma, he talked about back then, was he doesn't know how to respond to them. Because from Buddhism has actually some things that says very strongly. It says you should not be engaged in business that involve the production and the sale of weapons. That's one of the kind of categorical things Buddhism wants to say. But if he says that to them, then they might have to leave that job, and it's very hard to find work. So he didn't know what to say, and that was where he was kind of struggling in himself about how to respond to them. So the idea, we do look at our behavior, and maybe we don't want to take categorical points of view, like absolutely you shouldn't work for arms industry, but to look at it very honestly and say, is this really conducive to eliminating suffering within myself and the world around me? So many of you know the Four Noble Truths that are central to Buddhism. And the truths are that there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, which is clinging, there's a possibility of being free of suffering, which is awakening or freedom or nirvana, cessation. And then there's the Eightfold Path, the things we can do to help us become more free from the suffering. What's beautiful about this statement is that the first one is it just simply says there is suffering. It doesn't say you suffer or I suffer. It just says there's suffering. And that's, I think it's very profound, because we become more sensitive. The sense of being absolutely separate from other people, of being me as an individual here, separate from the suffering of others, begins to soften and disappear. And the idea is Buddhists are interested in suffering wherever they encounter it, not just simply in a kind of self-centered way, just their own suffering. And the path of mindfulness, the path of paying careful attention to our motivations, our feelings, our thoughts, careful, being sensitive to how it is other people are living, how other people are feeling, and that's a path that helps us understand how to alleviate suffering in the world. That's really the guide of Buddhist ethics. It has to do with suffering, harm. Is our behavior I'm doing going to create harm, or is it not going to create harm? And then to help us in this study, Buddhism offers five precepts, which are not commandments. They're not like given from some deity that says you have to do these. The precepts in Buddhism are understood to be training precepts. And as training precepts, they're not being taught to people as moralistic standards, this is the way you have to live your life, absolutely. And if you don't do this, you're going to, you're a bad person. It's saying these are really five important areas, five important suggestions, or five important guidelines that you want to really pay careful attention to. And if you're going to step across this line, if you're going to break this precept, you should wake up and really be very diligently mindful of why you're doing this and what the consequences are going to be. What are you losing touch with yourself? Are you really in touch with yourself in a deep way as you're about to lie to someone, deceive someone, steal from someone, abuse someone sexually, take advantage of them sexually or whatever? Are you really in touch with your deepest heart, your deepest sensitivity, your deepest intention when you're going to do these things? Chances are that if you're really deeply in touch with your heart's deepest heart, if your deepest sense of sensitivity and intention, it's probably impossible for you to be engaged in malicious deceit or malicious lying or greed, greedful stealing or whatever, harming other people. So the five precepts are this, not the moralistic standard, but it's more like a flag saying, oh, if you notice when you're going to cross break the precepts, wake up. Use it as a mindfulness inspiration to pay more careful attention to what's going on in your heart. So these five precepts are not to kill, not to steal. Actually, the wording is not to take what is not given. And that's a little bit, I think it's a little bit more stronger statement than not to steal. Because if it's not being given to you, you shouldn't take it. You find something that's been lost on the street and you can't find the owner, maybe you shouldn't just take it and assume you can have it. If it hasn't been given to you, for what you do. Not to take what is not given. And then the third is not to lie, or not to speak false words. And the fourth is not to harm others through our sexuality. And that's a beautiful way of saying the precept, because again, the focus in Buddhist ethics is on harm, not on some idea of purity or impurity or right or wrong, that some kind of sexuality is wrong, some kind is right. And rather, the question is there harm being produced in this kind of relationship? That saves a lot of the kind of endless discussions and painful discussions that go on in our about what kind of sexuality is appropriate and what kind of sexual orientation is appropriate and what's not. It's very simply, is it harming other people? Are you harming someone else in your behavior or not? And then the fifth precept is not to intoxicate the mind, not to be engaged in alcohol or drugs. And this is where different Buddhists will kind of state the precept a little differently. The precept that the Buddha said was don't consume intoxicants. Many people will interpret it to be don't take drugs and alcohol to the point that you get intoxicated. So that, you know, social drinking, some people say, is okay. The point being that it's very easy to break the other four precepts when a mind is not clear. And so because of the tremendous harm that we see from intoxication, it's best to avoid that. In any case, when we start noticing that we want to intoxicate ourselves, and we notice that tendency, if we stop and notice the motivation of why we're wanting to do it, and then really honest about it, and honest about whether this is well or not, is this really helping me to alleviate suffering in a serious way, or is it mostly just kind of dulling my senses to my suffering? I think that if you really do that investigation, probably the motivation, the interest in alcohol or drugs will drop. So people who are interested in Buddhist ethics and taking it on as a practice will think about these and think about how they apply to their daily life. What it means not to kill. How do I kill things? Most of us here probably don't go around killing other people. Otherwise, probably wouldn't be here. Often we get questions in this kind of context about, what about the ants in my kitchen or the snails in my garden? And there's endless discussions about snails and ants. Mm-hmm. And I don't really, have, the ultimate answer for how to take care of your snails and ants. But I think, even though it's people always bringing it up, I think it's really beautiful. I'm actually inspired that someone's interested enough and concerned enough that they raise the question, what do I do with the ants in my kitchen? As opposed to automatically spraying them. I think it's a beautiful thing. But there's other meanings of not to kill. Not to kill the life motivation of some other person. And that can take many different forms. One form perhaps is interrupting people a lot. If someone's trying to tell you something and you don't listen deeply to why they're telling you and what they're trying to tell you, and you jump in with your own opinion, there's a kind of a killing that happens there. I was recently trying to explain to someone who's important to me how I was feeling. And the person shot back with advice. And I felt like something inside of me kind of, well, at least got discouraged. I don't know if it died. I got very discouraged. I just wanted to be heard. I did many years of Zen training. And in Zen, in the monastery itself, in the very formal settings, one of the rules is you're not supposed to say no when someone offers you something. And I don't suggest that as a policy for daily life, but it's a very interesting training device, training practice. And mostly it takes the shape that in Zen you eat your meals often in the meditation hall, very formally, in silence with chanting, and people come and serve you your food. You're sitting there with a this, and someone comes up to you and offers you to serve you food or give you tea, or in the afternoon sometimes they come with a cookie. And the rule is you're never supposed to say no when someone comes to offer you something. And it was explained to me the reason for that is someone is coming with an act of generosity, that if you say no to them, you in a sense sever, interrupt that movement of generosity in the other person. And so you're supposed to always receive. And so you get very clever then in the monasteries about how to receive, but really get really little. If you don't, people go like this, you know. And if this means like just a little bit. But if you really don't want much at all, then you go like this. You just put it right next to your bowl. But you can't say no. And I noticed that that effect, after years of doing this, that had an impact on me. Outside of the monastery, it made me much more sensitive and appreciative of when people came to me to offer me something. The first time I noticed the sensitivity, I was at a dinner with someone, and big, long table. And someone walked all the way around and kind of forced their way kind of to the back to offer me tea. I didn't want tea. But something about this effort to offer me tea, I wanted to honor that, I really wanted to honor that effort, to honor that kind of act of generosity. So it wasn't a big deal to me. It wasn't like I didn't, you know, I was allergic to the tea or anything. So I thought, oh, thank you, and I took a little bit. So I'm much more sensitive because of that training to the movement of generosity from other people and what it means, and not to kind of kill it, not to put an end to it. So I'm talking about this because it's possible to understand the precepts in the most literal way, and then it's possible to understand them and in more kind of subtle ways. And I think often for many of us, it's the more subtle ways. I don't know how it is for some of you to with your sexuality and how, you know, do you create harm with your sexuality? I don't know, maybe you do, maybe you don't. But it can be very subtle, the ways in which we harm other people, hurt other people with sexuality. People have sexual desires and sexual fantasies all the time. And it's a pretty normal part of human life. But you can feel the sexual energy can build up inside of you. But then if you kind of, with the eye contact or with whatever, your way you use your body, whatever, begin spilling that over in subtle ways that people aren't interested in that, that's harming someone else. And I've seen that even on retreats. At the end of a retreat, that some person had all the sexual energy and was just oozing it out to her with his eye contact. It's fine to have sexual energy and feelings, but it's also fine to contain it within yourself so it doesn't harm other people. So there's many ways of understanding these things. And it's the more subtle ones, I think, which make it more enlivening for us and more interesting for us. Some people like to take the precept of no intoxication to include television. To include... what are some of the other things that we get intoxicated with? Our opinions, food. So, living a life which attempts not to harm other people or harm ourselves is the foundation for Buddhist ethics. So what do you think of that? Now it's your turn. Yes.
What did the monk say to his
congregation?
The man who was bringing the bombs.
Oh, he didn't tell us. The impression I had was that he didn't know what to do, and in his not knowing, he left them alone to make a livelihood for themselves. But it was painful. It was difficult for him. It's very interesting. This man, his name is Silananda, and it literally means the joy of precepts. Ananda means joy, and Sila is precepts or ethics. And one of the things that was a surprise to me when I came to Asia to practice in Asia was that people in Asia rejoice. Some Buddhists in Asia rejoice or feel all this joy at the fact that they're living an ethical life. And I thought that, you know, was kind of strange. I thought, you know, someone who lived an ethical, you know, really ethical and never gotten, you know, was, you know, kind of, you know, a sissy. You know, it didn't naturally generate a lot of respect within me when I was younger. And when I came to Thailand and noticed that people were really happy, it kind of generated joy when they reflected that they were living an ethical life. That caught my attention. And then it makes sense when the teachers in Southeast Asia, one of the things they recommend is if you're really feeling kind of down and discouraged or full of doubt or whatever in your meditation practice, they say, oh, reflect on your ethics, on your behavior, and then you'll feel joy and feel energy, and it's easier to meditate. You know, it never occurred to me. Yes. Yeah. We do the best we can. One of the things that this is not quite answering your question, but when I look at my own motivations for why I want to do things, sometimes I see that my motivations are mixed. Some of it might be selfish. Some of it might be someone else. Maybe I want to help someone, and part of the motivation is I want to get credit for helping them, so other people see what a great guy I am. It's a real pity for the pure desire to help someone. It's a real pity if that gets squashed because I don't want to act on my impure motivation. So it requires a kind of maybe deeper sacrifice, in a sense, to follow through on the 20% that's pure, than it is to stop doing it entirely. So in your situation, I think it's often the case that our behaviors are mixed, and we do the best we can and choose the one that has the least harm. And if it's possible to somehow acknowledge very respectfully the harm that we are creating, because then I think it's even better. So for example, an example that I have is I drive my car, and I create a lot of damage by driving that car. I mean, I don't have accidents, but just driving it, and the gas it uses and the exhausts, and I'm very sensitive and aware of that harm that I create. And my driving that car allows me to do a greater good than the harm that I create. And that's my hope. Sometimes I don't know. Sometimes it's based on hope or trust. Or can you want to give us an example? That's it.
How you weight your suffering.
That's very interesting when you feel that that person's suffering is not so separate from your own. So it's not so black and white between me and them. But their joy or their suffering is because of empathy, in a sense. You feel part of it. And it goes both directions. You can do something that helps alleviate your suffering, but causes suffering from someone else. Or you can do something that alleviates their suffering that causes you suffering. And ideally, we do something for both. We take care of both people. Do you eat meat? Because? Sorry? I mean, pesticides build as you go up. Oh, that sense. I see. Yes, Marty?
It does seem because of our total connectedness in every moment that every action or thought has inevitable
consequences. What's your definition of ethics in that statement?
Some of the things even that seem like clear, one can argue about which way is creating more suffering than the others. For me, I'd have, you know, it's easy for me to pitch out working in an armament factory can eliminate suffering.
Well, because if you have enough arms and you deter other people from getting into war.
Right, it might be because of my background and my tradition, but there are a lot of examples where a little bit more armament sooner may have helped a lot of people.
So it gets complicated, these issues. And what inspires me is that people take the issues seriously, to explore it and really find out and really find out to the best of their knowledge and best of their intelligence what they think the consequences are really going to be from these kinds of activity, and that interest to engage in that question. Is it what inspires me? To come to quick answers is not so inspiring. I saw hands over here, yeah?
Did the Buddha have a definition of suffering? An example for me would be suffering for me would be after Christmas having to. So, I mean, that's a suffering that I see is good, but nonetheless, it's hard to get going. Is there a better definition, or is there a more standard?
Well, let me ask you a question. Before I answer you, I'd like to ask you a question for me. Why were you motivated to do those exercises to burn off?
Well, actually, mostly.
Most of it is egotistical.
Yeah.
And what's the motivation behind being egotistical?
I want to be liked.
And what's happening behind the desire of wanting to be liked?
I don't want to be separate from others.
And you feel, is there suffering there in that kind of feeling of being separate? So that's the suffering we're more interested in. That suffering, I would argue, and maybe you disagree, but that suffering is what is motivating you to do all this stuff and to burn off the calories. And so there's a stronger suffering which is motivating you. And if you don't carefully look at the original suffering, but rather look at the kind of superficial one, then we don't really understand ourselves very well. But the definition of suffering is that there's a difference between pain and suffering, difference between discomfort and suffering. Suffering in the Buddhist, as I understand it, suffering in the Buddhist sense, the kind of suffering that Buddhist practices addresses, is a suffering that arises out of clinging. Clinging is a kind of psychological movement of holding, really pushing away in a way that's painful. And the freedom that Buddhism is looking for, freedom from suffering, is not freedom from never breaking our leg, or freedom from never being cold, or the freedom of never having to do exercise, which is uncomfortable maybe for sometimes, but rather it's a freedom that to no longer have any kind of aversion or clinging to the experience of being a human being. Does that make sense? Yes.
One part of
the usual way of understanding Buddhist ethics is that it tends to be more situational ethics. It has to do with you don't approach a situation with a preconceived idea of what is ethical, you know, rules of right and wrong, but rather you approach with this preconceived interest in is there suffering or freedom here? Is there happiness here or suffering? What causes suffering? What causes happiness in this situation?
It should be the opposite from one situation.
Yeah. And so it depends on the situation, and the example of sexual relationships is a good one because it's easy, kind of dramatic. Buddhism doesn't have any policy about who it's appropriate for you to marry or not marry, as a religion, but rather has been content to accept the mores of the cultures it went into. So in different cultures, it has a different position about what's appropriate, but it changes with the culture that it finds itself. And there are cultures where there's, you know, one man and many women, and there's some cultures in Tibet where there's many men, and you know, all kinds of things, situations. So ethics sometimes has part to the amount of suffering that our behavior causes is partly conditioned by what are the social beliefs of the culture or the community we live in. And it changes over time also. And it's very interesting in like a country like America that's so pluralistic, where you have a lot of different cultures trying to coexist. It's a big issue, but Buddhist ethics is situational. And it wants to look at each situation in its own right, and using the issue of suffering as its criteria. Yes?
Such things as just wars from the Buddhist point of view?
Well, this is where Buddhism is such a huge religion. I mean, there's so many different traditions and 2,500 years and different schools, and you know, it's like you know, Christianity has, you know, it's Christianity is younger than Buddhism, but it has, you know, a great diversity of teachings. So Buddhism has many kinds of Buddhism, and I would love to be able to say there's one true Buddhist position. However, one argument that, or I don't know if argument, or one point of view is that you would take the original teachings of the Buddha as the best representative of what Buddhism has to say, and the Buddha prohibit and to take his admonitions or his rules or for the monastics, his community of his closest disciples, as being an example of his, you know, how he felt you should live your life. And it was very clear that the monastics could not be involved in any kind of war, could not be involved in any kind of weapons, could not even talk about war with other people, could not be messengers between warring kings. It was a very, very strong pacifist stance for the monastics. However, the Buddha didn't feel like he had any authority to talk about what lay people should do. I mean, lay people used to live their own lives, and who was he to tell them anything? So he didn't actually come down and, you know, as far as I know, make a proclamation, you know, and say you have to kind of avoid war at all cost. But he did that for his close disciples. So my belief as a Buddhist is that, so this is where you're getting my point of view. I'm telling you what Buddhism, now I'll tell you what I think Buddhism is about. After saying that there's no Buddhism. Is a very strongly pacifist religion, and there's war is never justified. That's my position. However, there are Buddhists who have taken the other point of view, and there's actually Buddhist scriptures that argue about when it's appropriate, when it's justified for Buddhists to go to war. I don't read those scriptures. Well, as I've said other times, I think that some of these questions are very difficult to figure out, and I don't know how I would respond in a particular situation. I feel very strongly that being a pacifist is not being passive, and there are some very marvelous, wonderful strategies for civil disobedience, violent, non-violent resistance that has proven extremely effective in some places. And if we don't know about those strategies, it's very difficult to have a very informed discussion about when we should go to war and when we shouldn't. If you don't know the alternative, if you don't really know really well the alternatives to war, you're not going to feel there are any alternatives, and you're much more quickly, you'll go much more quickly going to. And so I don't know what the you know, in any particular situation, I don't know what's right, but I think it's very important for more people to educate themselves about nonviolence, about the strategies of nonviolence, so we can have a more intelligent discussion when a situation arises. We should have nonviolent training boot camps. Joy is the joy. Happiness is the opposite of not suffering. That's the idea. What? Oh, but you suffer terribly, and alienation and numbness. You become numb. That's a terrible kind of suffering. And people do that. People withdraw and become numb and aloof and closed down, and it's a kind of failed strategy to really alleviate suffering. It works in the short term, but it kind of hardens the heart. You acquire freedom, and freedom has a kind of joy in it. But who meets someone who's suffering is not going to go around dancing and laughing. A free person is going to sit there and feel very compassionate and really be moved by that in their context of their freedom. But But if they meet someone who's just extremely happy, who just, you know, just got married maybe, or something really great happened in their life, the person would share in that joy. And if they met someone who just had a terrible loss, their spouse just died or something, they'd share in them with this, the pain of that. So freedom allows us to move in a sensitive way through life and respond appropriately to the situation. It doesn't guarantee us to always, you know, be brimming full of joy. There's a kind of very subtle kind of joy that comes to that that freedom of movement. So the experience of nirvana, the experience of enlightenment in Buddhism, experience of absolutely not clinging to anything anymore, is sometimes called mahasukha, the great happiness. Yeah, we're supposed to become more happy. That's the whole point. The last one.
Can you talk a little bit more about freely feeling, sharing somebody's pain without suffering?
Well, it becomes very one of the functions of mindfulness practice. One of the things we learn by diligent mindfulness practice is willingness, a kind of comfort with being uncomfortable. And a lot of people don't know that. A lot of people feel uncomfortable and they react against it, they resist it, they judge it, they push it away, they whatever. And there's a lot of extra suffering that's created by the ways in which we react to discomfort, or comfort sometimes too. And by being dedicated or devoted to sitting, for example, and sitting here for 40 minutes and not moving, regardless of how uncomfortable you get, is training you, hopefully, not to be numb to that pain, but training you to study really carefully the movements of towards self-pity, towards aversion, towards hate, towards impatience, towards boredom, that adds all the unnecessary kind of problems on top of it. And eventually what can be found is a kind of equanimity or peacefulness or non-reactivity that allows us to feel, in a sense, comfortable or at ease even when we're uncomfortable. And if we don't have that ability, then whenever we get uncomfortable, we react. And one of the places we can get uncomfortable is in the presence of other people's suffering. If someone's dying in front of you, or someone just had their spouse die, you're not going to feel comfortable if you're in their presence. Comfortable with being uncomfortable. You don't have to create any more suffering. That kind of discomfort is not suffering. That's just life. The suffering is when we kind of tighten up around it. So let's end with a couple of minutes of sitting. Just 1 or 2 minutes.